Today is the first day of our July-August 2017 7-day Sesshin. It's the 30th of July. And today we're going to do a bit of a review of some of the basics of practice. This will probably continue into tomorrow's talk as well. Can be quite easy to fall into bad habits, and sometimes going over some of the basic instructions, we may hear something differently, hear something that we haven't heard before, and because of that, get a new perspective and be able to come at the practice from a new angle. So this is something that can be helpful to do periodically. And I want to start with talking a little bit about posture, because posture is the foundation of all the practices. It may be stating the obvious, but we sit because it's the easiest posture in which to do our work of turning the mind around and looking inward. And since body and mind are not two, a stable, balanced, and gathered in sitting posture with the limbs, preferably with the limbs coming toward the center of the body, is the one that best supports cultivating a stable, balanced, concentrated mind. And everybody probably knows this, but the stability that is so important comes from having a stable base, the three points of contact with the mat or the floor and the chair, if you're sitting in a chair. So if you find you haven't got those three points of contact, then make sure that you support your knees, if it's your knees that are up, or if you can raise yourself up higher so that you can get your knees down with or without support, that's going to be very helpful. If we do have the stable base, then we can sit with a minimum of tension. We can relax the rest of the body held up by the stable base. If we don't have those three points of contact, then we're likely to be wobbly and also to be using extra energy to hold us in the position, and that's not what we want. You want to be able to release into the posture, to relax into it. So a strong, broad base is essential. If you're sitting in a chair, then it means the feet flat on the floor. When we do have the space, then the upper part of the body can be light and unconstricted, expansive. It really pays to take time to get into the right position when we first sit down. Really, the most important thing is getting into a position where we can sit still comfortably and at the same time be alert. In a sense, we sit to attention in our zazen, with this broad base and then stretching up to the apex ahead. So one master described it as being like having, like a mountain has its feet firmly on the ground and its head in the clouds. It is also important, even though we can do well to just every time we sit down, we carefully get into our posture, it's also important not to get too obsessive about having absolutely perfect posture. everyone is in some sense asymmetrical. And just one obvious way in which we're asymmetrical is generally if you're right-handed, you'll be tighter on that side. If you're left-handed, you'll be tighter on that side. Our dominant side, which is our stronger side, tends to be less flexible. So that's something we just end up having to work with. The thing is to do our best with it and to continue to work with it, because it is something that can continue to evolve over many, many, many years. We just do our best to get in a posture that is good enough for us to be able to sit still and release the body. But coming out of an understanding that it's really a mental attitude that is the key, and the physical can follow that rather than lead. There are stories of masters and doing long solo retreats who haven't got access to any kind of medicine or medical care, who through their assiduous zazen cure themselves of different illnesses. Of course, we don't know exactly what those illnesses were, but this is possible, that there can be changes in the body-mind as a result of our zazen, though we can't rely on that completely. There are also many stories of masters and practitioners who had to work with different kinds of physical infirmity and illness. So with this, it's really a matter of trying to find that middle way of not getting too obsessive about the posture, but giving it its due and working with the body. Zazen is a physical process. Shodo Harada Roshi, the abbot of Sogenji, with some people from our center have gone for training, and Roshi went there too. He says that practice is all about alignment. We align the body, we align the breath, and then we align the mind. And then ultimately we go beyond that to really aligning our whole being with the true self, with what pervades all of existence, the whole universe. He talks about the four postures, and this comes from classical Buddhism. Walking, standing, sitting, lying down. I'd like to read a bit from Shodo Harada Roshi's book, The Path to Bodhidharma. Talking about these four postures. There are times in which we are engaged in activity, and he relates activity to the first one, walking, which he calls in fact moving, gyo. There are times in which we are engaged in activity, gyo, during which we attempt to remain focused and aware, times of standing still, ju, during which we attempt to return to the source and observe the content of our minds, times of sitting, za, during which we delve even deeper into our inner source, and finally, times of lying down, ga, when we rest our bodies. The first of the four postures, moving, is fundamentally not one in which we turn inward and observe ourselves. Activity requires that we direct our energies outward toward whatever it is we're doing. Standing still permits a greater inner focus, but it is in the posture of sitting that this element finds its deepest expression. It goes on to tell the story of hearing a performer of traditional Japanese comic anecdotes, which are called rakugo, talk about the relationship between sitting and comedy. This performer said that genuine humor touches upon something universal in human beings, something that cuts across individual and cultural differences. If this element, this universal element, is missed, then even the most skillfully related rakugo will fail to evoke either laughter or sadness in the audience, even if the people see the story's point. The performer then added that it is extremely hard to move people at this deep inner level when they're standing, but relatively easy when they're sitting, particularly when they're sitting not in chairs but solidly on the floor in the traditional Japanese fashion. It's an interesting point. You think how if you have to tell somebody some bad news or talk about something that has some weight or gravity to it, you sit down with the person. I'm sure it's we do it almost instinctually, but it probably has to do with our understanding at some level that when we sit down, we can engage with each other at a deeper level and with our own minds more deeply. Harada Roshi continues, "Thus there is something about the sitting posture that facilitates access to the deeper regions of the heart, and this is true of Zazen as it is of Rakugo. When we assume the sitting position, we quite naturally draw closer to something universal in the human spirit. Merely sitting is not in itself sufficient to bring about peace of mind, of course, but it does have a certain settling effect on even the most troubled soul. This is something we experience at a far more fundamental level than that of intellectual speculation. Doctrinal questions, for example, what is salvation or what did the Buddha teach, are certainly important, but in Zazen it is more essential first to find that state of settled tranquility in which all of humanity has a share. Differences in culture, language, and national temperament definitely exist, but there is a certain place of settled tranquility where we all naturally come to rest." He continues, "Zazen is not a matter of intellection. It must be rooted in the physical sense of inner liberation that is most easily experienced through sitting. The sense of liberation is not in itself enough, however. It is also necessary to attain an inner state open to the essential nature of things. If liberation was all that mattered, it would be enough to drug ourselves to sleep, but this would hardly resolve the problem of how to act in our everyday lives from a stable inner essence, regardless of how turbulent or dangerous the outer circumstances are." I think this connects to what we were talking about last night, that what we're seeking is just not some kind of personal liberation or relief of our disquiet, but much more than that. We're seeking for a way to truly live in the world that we in which we find ourselves. A way, how can we respond when in a dangerous situation or with a person, an aggressive person or a person to whom we feel a lot of aversion? And here Harada Roshi calls it the stable inner essence. What is it that is unmoved when things are crazy? That stands its own ground, so to speak. Haradaroshi says that this is where the importance of sitting becomes clear, because it's when we're sitting that we're most easily able to stabilize ourselves and to touch this essence. A little more about the physical aspect of finding this stability. When we first get into the posture, to go through the process of making sure that we lengthen the backs of our thighs as we settle onto the cushions, and generally that means leaning the upper part of the body forward. And stretching the buttocks away from the bone, so to speak. Sometimes it can help even to put the hands back there and stretch the flesh up as you settle into the seat. And what this does is it helps to get the tilt in the pelvis, where the top of the pelvis moves forward a little bit, the bottom edge of the pelvis moves back. And so there's a slight curve in the lower back, and this is really what provides the strength to support our upper body, which then can be relaxed and open. And if you get that tilt in the pelvis right, it will be virtually effortless to get the upper part of the body coming up from that base. And the back of the neck needs to be long and the chin very slightly tucked in. That happens just coming out of the back of the neck being long, but not tight. We're not pulling our chin in towards the neck as if we were a marine or something. It should be quite soft. Used to be said, I don't know if this is still said in the workshops, but to have one's the back of one's neck touching the collar of the robe. Well, so you have the instruction sometimes to settle the energy in the hara, or the tanden. And Haradaroshi has quite a lot to say about this. It puts a big emphasis in their tradition on the tanden and on the flow of the energy through the body, the chi. And he says that this feeling of strength in the tanden, 2 or 3 inches below the navel, emerges out of getting ourselves into alignment. And he says it is important, however, to think of the tanden not as a specific point on the body, but as something that appears when a number of factors are in proper balance. The tanden is, in a sense, the expression of an overall condition. It will not appear unless the upper trunk is relaxed, the back straight, and the lumbar area is firmly tucked in, which is just what we were talking about. When the back is curved, the trunk naturally straightens, and the ki, the vital energy, flows freely upward along the spine. If we don't have this slight curve in the lower back, then it can cause a lot of tension to build up in our shoulders and our neck, which can be quite painful. So The pain appears up in the upper back, but the actual way to correct it is lower down. And this is why it's important to take care when sitting down to get that tilt there. And if you're sitting cross-legged, to sit towards the front edge of your cushion, so that helps get the cushion into a kind of a wedge shape that supports the pelvis's tip, the right angle. So if we take care with us getting into our posture, then we'll feel a kind of firmness, a sense of integration and stability. Another image, a helpful image, is to imagine ourselves as a great tree. And the branches stretching up are our upper body, lengthening up towards the sky. But then the roots that you don't see are also stretching down beneath us into the ground. So we feel earthed. Much more could be said about posture, but we'll just leave it at that. And move on to looking at the various practices that people are doing, just a little bit on each one. And the way that we're going to approach these is just by approaching via what might be considered the pitfalls of each different practice. Starting with breath practice, which is, of course, foundational, like the posture. Not just actually for our zazen, but for us at any given moment. Of course, the breath is with us until we die. In fact, the cessation of the breath is virtually a definition of death. Now, not so much these days because of all the interventions that can happen, but throughout history, human beings have associated breath with life itself. So we couldn't get much more basic than to work with the breath. Probably a fairly common pitfall with breath practice is forcing it rather than just letting it settle on its own. For the most of our lives, the breath is happening perfectly without our conscious intervention, and it can do that. And we really just have to get out of the way and allow it to function beautifully. But we can come to the breath with ideas about it. We may have in mind an ideal way we think the breath should be, a kind of mental picture that we've created. We may think it should be deep or soft or from the hara or long or slow, any number of things. But if we're holding these things in mind, then they'll get in the way. And inevitably, if we are forcing in some kind of a way, or trying to make the breath like this or like that, then that will lead to tension and discomfort. And it also reinforces us, or can reinforce our sense of self. I am here doing something to the breath. And that's exactly what we're dissolving if we're undertaking the practice correctly. There is just one exception to this general instruction to not force or try to control the breath, and that is when we first sit down. It can be helpful when we've got into our posture, we're taking up the practice, just for those first two or three breaths to take deeper breaths. And also at the beginning, particularly, to emphasize exhalation. And this can, you can breathe through your mouth. Generally we breathe through the nose, but in these first few breaths, to breathe through the mouth. And just be sure that we're breathing all the way out. You can even imagine that as you're breathing out those first few breaths, you're breathing out all the thoughts that are gathered in you, in your heart and your mind. In that way, we make a kind of a conscious break between our ordinary, scattered way of just letting the thoughts go every which way, and sitting down and taking up the breath practice, where we're releasing those thoughts. We're not getting caught up in them. If we do exhale fully, completely, then the air will just flow back in effortlessly. Really, we can get a sense of receiving the breath rather than taking a breath. Then after those first few breaths of long or full exhalations, then just to come back to the natural breath. And bringing a kind of a light, easy attention to each inhalation and exhalation. We're not trying to go somewhere in doing breath practice, get somewhere, but rather to fully participate in what is happening right now. So to pay great attention to each phase of the breath, and just be fully present, whether we're inhaling or in the moment before we exhale, or we're exhaling in the moment before we inhale. And if we notice tension, whether it's physical tension or something we're holding mentally, then to see if we can just release that, whatever it is, as we breathe out. And then again, allow the air to flow back in. If the air doesn't just flow in all by itself, filling the vacuum that's created by the exhalation, then again, it may be that we're holding back. And so just see if you can relax, especially at the end of the exhalation. Not forcing anything, but just a sense of softening. Now, just for the last part of the Taisho, I'd like to start talking a little bit about Shikantaza. Shikantaza is a Japanese word that means just sitting. And in it, in a classical way that it's taught, the focus is on just sitting, just on the physical posture of the body in space and the breath as it goes in and out of that body, said that posture is particularly important for Shikantaza, that we are aligned and sitting strong and tall like a mountain. And that's it, just being aware of whatever arises as we sit there. It's a very subtle practice, and it's one of the reasons why it's not assigned to beginners, because it's not really possible to do effective Shikantaza without a mind that is already pretty stable. Either we just end up thinking as we sit there, so not really focused on the physical posture, but just sort of sitting there and thinking our normal thoughts, or maybe we'll get a little bit of concentration, but there are still subtle things going on in the mind, more subtle levels of thought, and we may not be aware of them. So we think we've quieted the mind, and it can be quite pleasant. The mind can be relatively empty, but we've sort of fallen really into a state of dullness. And so this is sometimes referred to as quietism, where it's kind of a bit stagnant. The ancient masters who were critical of this would call it dead sitting. So then the question arises, well, how do we make sure that we're not falling into quietism, into dead sitting? Well, we need to bring some rigor to it and honesty, and try to be, if we do, the mind gets quiet, is to kind of search out the more subtle levels of thought, and then release those and concentrate the mind more fully on the physical posture. I came across an article by Master Sheng Ye, Chinese master who died a few years ago, and he offered something I hadn't come across before. It's not something I've tried myself, though it is similar to some of the things from the Tibetan tradition, which where they have a range of practices which are somewhat akin to Shikantaza. So, for the rest of this Taisho, and then also tomorrow, we'll continue. I don't think we'll get through it today, but we'll have a look at this article by Master Sheng Yin and his suggestions for how we can avoid falling into dead sitting. And in this, he brings in the Chinese teaching on Shikantaza, which is known as silent illumination. The article is entitled Shikantaza and Silent Illumination, and it is based on a lecture given by Master Sheng Yin during a December 1993 Chan retreat. The Zen, Chinese. He says, the Japanese term Shikantaza literally means just sitting. Its original Chinese name, Mojiao, means silent illumination. Silent refers to not using any specific method of meditation and having no thoughts in your mind. Illumination means clarity. You are very clear about the state of your body and mind. When the method of silent illumination was taken to Japan, it was changed somewhat. The name given to it, just sitting, means just paying attention to sitting, or just keeping the physical posture of sitting, and this was the new emphasis. The word silent was removed from the name of the method, and the understanding that the mind should be clear and have no thoughts was not emphasized. In silent illumination, just sitting is only the first step. While you maintain the sitting posture, you should also try to establish the silent state of the mind. Eventually, you reach a point where the mind does not move, and yet it is very clear. That unmoving mind is silent, and the clarity of mind is illumination. This is the meaning of silent illumination. I think this is very helpful, and I think it restores perhaps something that is not so emphasized in the Japanese tradition. It's there, but perhaps is not as emphasized as it needs to be by some practitioners. He goes on, Faith and Mind, a poem attributed to the third patriarch of Chan, Tseng San, and this, of course, is what we call affirming faith in mind, begins something like this. The highest path is not difficult, so long as you are free of discriminations. Our translation is, the great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. But he has the highest path is not difficult, so long as you are free of discriminations. Really, these two lines sum up the Buddha Dharma. Highest path is not difficult, so long as you are free of discriminations. He goes on, discriminations can also be translated as choices, selections, or preferences. The highest path is not difficult if you are free from choosing, selecting, or preferring. Now, to be clear, that he doesn't mean here that we have to become zombies. At breakfast, we choose what to eat and how much tea to put in our cup. But what the third ancestor is talking about is all the discriminating that we do on top of making those kinds of choices. All the unnecessary picking and choosing that we do, often in advance of something happening, in anticipation of something happening. And woven into those discriminations is that the urge that we have for self-protection, for self-advancement, our self-partiality, in other words. Trying to avoid what we don't like and avoid the unpleasant and seek out or keep hold of what we find to be pleasant. I have a recurring example of this where I get anxious about choosing a topic for Teisho. I start worrying about if I don't choose it soon enough, then I won't have time to put the talk together and then the talk will be crap. And not only that, if I take too long working on the talk, then I won't get a chance to rest and then I'll feel crap all day. But the irony of this is that that anxiety in itself constricts my mind and makes it harder for me to choose the Teisho topic and to do what I need to do. And that's another way of understanding this picking and choosing here. We can just think of it as constriction. We tighten up. We hold ourselves against some imagined problem or threat. Well, maybe this is a good time to stop. We'll stop here and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow